Lines like this can be a little bit of a help in piecing together what's going on in the kingdom of Israel as we study these things. I have been a proponent for a long time that understanding the histories that are given to us in the scripture will help you understand everything else that's in there, especially when it comes to Old Testament prophets. How do you know what those prophets are talking about? Well, you have to know the history that's going on around them in order to fully understand it. And so one of my hopes as we go through this series of kingly lessons is not only that we'll draw some applications directly from the texts that we're looking at, but also that you'll come away with a better grasp of Israel's history from beginning to end. Well, maybe not from beginning, since we only started with the kingdom and not way back at Abraham. But you understand the history of the kingdom of Israel and how that has affected the things that were said to her. All of the writing prophets, aside from Moses, occur during the kingdom period. The book of Judges records that there were some prophets running around, but nobody left anything written for us. It wasn't God's purpose. Moses is the only writing prophet that occurs before the kingdom period. And so when you get into Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, and all the rest of them, and if you're like me, you have a hard time listing off those 13 minor prophets, right? They're not easy to remember. Anybody know them all in order? Daniel? Oh, yeah, we've had our kids working on it, and I'm trying to. Anybody else got them in order? You can say it. Not to put you on the spot or anything. Eldon, you know them all? You rearranged them. Well, now I'm going to be completely off.
Well, what happened was the lesson was trying to show us that the Bible was not written by men, but by God. So it was chronological
order. No, it wasn't.
And to give us the reason why the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it was written in chronological order. The prophets wrote them down from time to time, right? But, yeah, we don't have it preserved in bound in chronological order. And one of the things that'll get you on that is Isaiah writes towards the end of the northern kingdom. Daniel and Ezekiel both write during the Babylonian captivity. And then you can get to Joel, who is probably the earliest of the prophets, who writes even before Isaiah. And so, yeah, as you go down through those list of prophets, if you assume that they were put in our Bible in chronological order, it'll throw off all kinds of understanding. So some of them record dates for us, some of them don't. But as we go through this study of the kingdom, we will be trying to point out where some of these prophets write and what they're talking about. So David takes the throne in about 1040 B.C., Saul had reigned for 40 years, then David reigns for 40 years, and that brings us right about to, it's a little before that, 1045 maybe, but it takes us to right about the turn of the first millennium B.C. when Solomon takes the throne, and he reigns for another 40 years. And then his son Rehoboam takes the throne. Now this chart that we are looking at here lays out the divided kingdom for us so that we can sort of see what's happening here. And he gives us the dates in nice big numbers. Now, I want to reiterate that these dates might differ from the notes in your study Bible by a matter of a few years. That's not a problem. When we're talking about Old Testament chronology, if we're within a few years of each other, that's okay. If you're off by a matter of decades or centuries, that's a problem. Because when we put together the chronology of the Old Testament, there are some pieces of data that, depending on how you take it, can adjust your figures, you know, a few years one direction or the other. So I know some people like Ryrie have put together lists. Usher, of course, put together a very, very famous list. I think Answers in Genesis has a very decorative wall chart of Old Testament chronology. It's all very good stuff. I have used this fella for some number of years. I like the way he reasons it and explains it, and it matches what I see there. So this is the one I use. It's probably going to be very close. And I think the matter of difference is maybe just a few years. off one way or the other. So he places Rehoboam from 975 BC to 958 BC. And those dates are not as critical for us to remember. You want to try to get the order of the kings as best you can. I know that's going to be tricky, but if you know right about where they are, if you can say, you know what, was Josiah toward the beginning of the kingdom or the end of the kingdom? He's toward the end. That'll really help you if you just know the relative placement of the kings. But anyway, here we see Rehoboam reigns for 17 years, and you can see his reign lined up with Jeroboam of the northern kingdom. So, of course, Jeroboam ruled longer, 22 years, so his reign extends a little farther. And then we have Abijam, who we looked at last week, whose reign only lasted for 3 years. And he brings the southern kingdom down to about 955 or so B.C. So this gives you just a little bit of an idea, and we'll try to flip back and forth and reference these things as we're going. But we're also going to bring up our map as we look at, I haven't even told you yet, have I? The passage is 1 Kings chapter 15. And I'm turning the wrong way. 1 Kings chapter 15. We covered about the first 8 verses or so last week. And we covered the rule of Abijam. Abijam, good king, bad king? Bad king, right. His rule is summarized. Now, we have to understand that when it gives us that epitaph, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, or he did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, we're getting a summary statement of his rule. It doesn't mean he never did anything good. It means that, for the most part, you could summarize his rule as being very bad. He was not a faithful guy. And so we cross-referenced into Chronicles and saw that there was a time in his reign, at the very beginning of it, when he was faced with a major battle with Jeroboam of the northern kingdom. And Abijam was extremely outnumbered, 800,000 troops against 500,000. And so he was highly outnumbered, and yet he called upon the Lord, and the Lord saved him, and they defeated the northern kingdom in that battle. And it was a decisive battle because it set the northern kingdom back for almost a generation, militarily, economically, and politically. And so that enabled the southern kingdom of Judah to maintain a very strong power base for the next 15 or 20 years. And that sets up things that are going to happen in the future. And so he had a moment where he called upon the Lord in a faithful way, but then the rest of his rule didn't really get summarized with a statement of faithfulness. And so Abijam goes down in the annals as being, for the most part, a faithless fellow. And so that brings us up through the end of verse 8 of chapter 15. Abijam slept with his fathers. They buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, reigned in his place. A little interesting tidbit for you. I think Martin Luther said that if it ever said he slept with his fathers, he took that to mean the guy was saved and was a righteous, faithful person. We have to understand that when we're looking at the Old Testament, these descriptions are not telling us whether these people had saving faith. They are telling us what their rule looked like. Does that make a good distinction? So some of these guys could have been saved individuals, and you got to understand, too, that's applying a New Testament term to the Old Testament. But these guys could have been saved individuals, but just very disobedient. Is it possible for a Christian to be faithful and saved and yet disobedient? Sure it is. And what happens? God disciplines, doesn't he? Paul tells us in Corinthians that the reason some of the Corinthian people were sick and that some had even died was that they were being disobedient. Hebrews warns us that there is a judgment even for the people of God, that if we're not walking obediently, God might discipline his children with sickness or with death. So yeah, it is very possible for somebody that is a genuine believer, genuinely faithful, to be walking in disobedience. So when we read these descriptions about he was wicked or he did what was right, we're not talking about the condition of their soul. We're talking about the condition of their kingdom. What kind of kingdom did they administer? And so Abijam goes down as having administered a faithless kingdom. He didn't do very well. But we'll see what happens next. Verse 9, in the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa, began to reign over Judah. So let's jump back to our timeline here. We can see Rehoboam ruled, and then his son Abijam ruled for 3 years, and then Asa rules for 41 years. So you can get an idea of how much history is elapsing here when you look at the size of his portion of the chart versus what's going on in the northern kingdom. So Asa begins right here at this line in 955 BC, and that's still during the reign of Jeroboam in the northern kingdom. But while Asa is king, Jeroboam's going to die. We're going to have another guy named Nadab, who only rules for 2 years, and then Baasha is going to take the throne. And then there's going to be a fella Eli, and then another fella Tibni, and then another fella Omni, and then another fella Ahab. So there's a lot going on up in the northern kingdom, all during the time that Asa is king of the southern kingdom. Kind of tricky to keep it all in place, isn't it? But that's what's happening here. And so Asa, in the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, began to reign over Judah, and he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. Now, that should be ringing a bell in your brain, because where else did we see the name Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom? That's Abijam's mom as well. If you go back to verse 2 of chapter 15, we're talking about Abijam. It says he reigned for 3 years. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. So how can Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom, be the mother of both Abijam and his son Asa? That's a possibility that Abijam actually did marry his mother. It was not an unheard of happenstance, but it's probably not as likely. Yes. Yes, very often a grandson can be termed a son. And so we may not be looking at a direct generational relationship here. We might be looking at this is his grandmother. I think what's going on here, you could very, very rightfully to the text take the stance that Abijam married his mother. The other option is that Maacah remained on as what is called the queen mother. It was a political position in the kingdom. And it was normally given to the direct mother of the king. But it's very possible that something happened to Asa's mother, and so Maacah remained on as queen mother. Jim, you were going to say something. Well, hey, we have Paul rebuking somebody in Corinthians for having an illicit relationship with his stepmother, right? So, the world is a crazy, wicked place. Weirder things have happened. So, it is completely textually possible to take the position that Maacah married her son. I think probably more likely that it's talking about the position of queen mother and referring to that. Because that would have been a position of great influence over the king as well. Either way, this is Maacah, and we said this is the daughter of Absalom, which is another way to vocalize that Hebrew word Abishalom, Absalom, David's son. Verse 11, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. So, good king, bad king? Good, very good, actually, right? David. One of the best kings. He's going to be the standard by which all the other kings are judged throughout the history of Israel. And so Asa does a good job. He lives up to it. Look at this description of all the things he accomplished during his rule. He put away the male cult prostitutes out of the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. You remember Rehoboam brought most of these in? Solomon brought them in. Rehoboam, probably Abijam, continued the practice. So here it's left to Asa to try and purge the kingdom of all this pagan religious practice. And so he is able to do it to a great deal. He removed all the idols that his fathers had made. He also removed Maacah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. We talked about Asherah. Asherah was considered the female, consort of the storm god Baal. And so she would have been a female god, and she would have been married to Baal in their conception. And we actually, there's a little bit of archaeological fun stuff. They found a, I think it's a stone. It was buried in southern Israel, and it was dedicated to Jehovah and his Asherah. And so somebody, somewhere along the way, got the idea that Jehovah God is kind of like the gods of the Canaanites and the Philistines, and that if they had wives, then surely Jehovah must have a wife. And so they dedicated this little stone to Jehovah and his Asherah, his consort goddess. And so, boy, the threat of what's called syncretism is always real. We have to constantly be purging out all of the stinking thinking about what God is like by getting rid of the ideas of what the world tells us God is like and strictly going by what does God's word tell us. God has revealed himself. We are not free to conceive of God however we wish. We have to take him at his word. And that's why we're so constantly drawn back to it. Well, because of her decision to worship this Asherah, Asa is put in that put in the predicament of having to remove his grandmother from her station in the kingdom. He has to depose her and demote her and remove her from a position of influence, lest she lead the kingdom into greater idolatry. And so he does. That takes quite a bit of courage. Asa cut down her image and burned it in the brook Kidron. Now, Kidron is just a little brook that flows right outside of Jerusalem. And today it's covered by a cemetery. And it was a place very often where the idols of the foreign gods were burned or destroyed in some way as a judgment to them. Verse 14, but the high places were not taken away. Now, this is a statement. We're going to read this very often throughout these histories. This term high places sometimes refers to, it always refers to a place up on a hill where there would be a little altar built. Sometimes it means they were worshiping pagan gods there. Sometimes it means the people of Israel were building little chapels to Jehovah on top of these things. And so you have to sort of think through, would this be a pagan altar or would this be a chapel to Jehovah? If it's a pagan altar, then obviously it should go, right? If it's a chapel to Jehovah, what do you think? Let's apply our corporate biblical wisdom to something like that. Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Eldon. Okay, so Eldon says it's probably not God's will because God had prescribed all worship to happen at Jerusalem. Okay? Daniel? Okay, so you agree with Eldon. They should go because they're not according to God's law. Okay? Any others? I mean, don't we want all the people of Israel to be able to remember the Lord and worship him? I mean, it's an awful long drive to Jerusalem, isn't it? We're not supposed to worship God the wrong way. We're not supposed to worship him our way. Right. Okay, so, yeah, you guys are on the right track here. Glad to hear it. We are not free to worship God according to our own thinking. He determines how we come to him. He always has, he always will. How did Cain come to God? How did Cain approach God in worship? The wrong way, with a grain sacrifice, right? With a sacrifice of his own making. How did Abel approach the Lord God? With blood. And so we have to understand that we are not free to just invent our own modes and forms of worship. We have to follow the instructions God's given us. So it might seem like a good idea, and obviously it did to somebody, to put these little chapels to Jehovah. I mean, after all, they put a little altar to the Asherah there. Why wouldn't we just put one to Jehovah there? I mean, at least then we have some kind of witness for Jehovah in the midst of all this pagan idolatry, right? No, because it's not the way God told us to do it. Asa recognizes that. He's tearing them down, but he doesn't get all of these little chapels to Jehovah torn down. They still remain. Nevertheless, verse 14, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days. And he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels. So if you remember back, let me go to our timeline. This is Asa. We're describing his 41 years of rule. Way back here in the fifth year of Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up and pillaged southern Judah, including Jerusalem. And he took away all the gold, stripped the gold off the doors and off the inside of the temple. He took all the gold articles that were inside and he took them back to Egypt. So the temple has been left almost desolate. It's still operating. It's still there. But it's nowhere near the glory that it was under Solomon because of Shishak. So we go through Rehoboam, we go through Abijam, and into the reign of Asa before he begins trying to restore the temple to the place of glory that it should have. So he begins dedicating his own treasures to the house of the Lord and trying to rebuild it. Verse 16, there was war between Asa and Baasha, the king of Israel, all their days. Now, if it's confusing to you that he says Baasha, the king of Israel, and not Jeroboam, it is because, if you remember, the chronicler is going to follow Asa, and then he'll back up and he'll catch us up on the northern kingdom. And when he catches us up, he'll bypass Asa, and then he'll come back and catch us up on the southern kingdom. So we're going to be doing this leapfrogging the whole way through the book of Kings. So, just again, to get you some perspective, we're looking at Jeroboam reigns for 22 years. Nadab is going to reign for 2 years, and that's Jeroboam's son. And at the end of this chapter 15, we will see the description of how Baasha takes over the rule of the northern kingdom. But suffice it to say for now, that Baasha has Nadab assassinated and takes over the rule right on about the third year of Asa's reign. So Asa's been on the throne for 3 years, and then Baasha takes control of the northern kingdom. And the relationship between Asa and Baasha is not good. Remember that Abijam, back here, defeated Jeroboam and secured the safety of the kingdom for quite some time here, for several years. Asa then is going to renew these wars with Baasha. Here's one description of the wars that happened between Baasha and Asa. I've got to pause here, actually, because it's going to describe this attack that Baasha makes, which takes place towards the end of Asa's rule. So it is probably down here, or it's in the middle of Asa's rule, towards the end of Baasha's rule. Because for the beginning part, most of Asa's rule, it says, of course, he was very faithful to the Lord his God, but there are a couple of scenarios that he runs into in which he completely abandons God, completely goes the other direction. And we got to turn to those things in 2 Chronicles, okay? So I want you to turn to 2 Chronicles. We're going to try to, as quickly as we can, cover those issues. And we're looking at chapter 14 and 15 of 2 Chronicles, 14, 15, and 16 actually describe Asa and his rule. Some of it is going to be a repetition of what we've just read. Some of it's going to be new material that the writer of Kings didn't include for us. Abijah slept with his fathers, that's Asa's dad, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa, his son, reigned in his place. In his days, the land had rest for 10 years. So there's that period that Abijam secured by defeating the northern kingdom, at least 10 years of rest where there was no war. Asa did what was right and good in the sight of the Lord his God. He took away the foreign altars. We've read those things. Verse 4, he commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, and to keep the law and the commandment. He also took out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the incense altars. And the kingdom had rest under him. So there's another one of those instances where it says he took the high places out, but back in Kings it said he didn't take the high places out. Remember, we said there's two kinds of high places. There's the pagan idolatrous high places, and there's the chapels to Jehovah type high places. He took out the pagan ones. He left the other ones. Okay? So that's why you're seeing a little bit of a discrepancy there. He built fortified cities in Judah, for the land had rest, and he had no war in those years, and the Lord gave him peace. And he said to Judah, let's build these cities, surround them with walls and towers. And so just keep going down through there and scanning with it a little bit, verses 7 and 8. He's fortifying cities, he's raising armies, and so throughout the beginning, the first 10 years of his rule, Judah is getting strong. They are reforming religiously, they're coming back to the right worship of God, and their armies are growing. And so it says he has 300,000 from Judah and 280,000 men from Benjamin that carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. You might pause there and think, wait a second, I thought Benjamin was one of the smallest of the tribes. It is. But we also have to remember, too, that he's not necessarily talking about just the people descended from Benjamin and Judah. He's talking about the people that live in those territories. And when Jeroboam split the northern kingdom off, there was a mass exodus of people from his kingdom that came down and lived in the southern kingdom. So many of them probably settled in Benjamin. And so that's why they're able to raise this massive army of his. All right. But then verse 9 is where we get into this interesting little tidbit of one of Asa's major accomplishments. Verse 9, Zerah, the Ethiopian. Now, Ethiopia is not the same as what you think of as Ethiopia. Our Ethiopia is south of Egypt. This Ethiopia is probably the one west of it. But at any rate, it's over there in Egypt. It's over there in, what is that continent called? Africa. Zerah the Ethiopian came out against them with an army of how many? A million men. You got to say, Zerah has probably emptied his country in order to do this. To raise an army of a million fighting men probably left not too many guys at home at this point. Okay, this is a huge, huge military force. They have 300 chariots, and they came as far as Mereshah. And Asa went out to meet him, and they drew up their lines of battle in the valley of Zarephath at Mereshah. And Asa cried to the Lord his God. Look at this. Here's this faithful guy. He sees this army of a million men. And how many men does he have? Yeah, about 580,000. And that's if he takes all of them and leaves the country defenseless. Okay. So here you are, outnumbered 2-1. If you use everything you've got, that's not a great place to be, is it? Well, it's a fine place to be if you realize that battles aren't won and are fought and won with swords and spears. They're fought and won with the Lord. And Asa recognizes that. So here's his prayer. O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this multitude. Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against you. So the Lord defeated the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. Asa and the people who were with him pursued them as far as Gerar, which is far south in Judah. And the Ethiopians fell until none remained alive, for they were broken before the Lord and his army. So Asa completely routs this army of a million men and wipes them out. And all of the pillage and plunder that comes from wiping out an army of that size is his. And suddenly, not only does his country have this great victory to its credit, it's also got all this wealth to its credit. It says, they attacked all the cities around Gerar, for the fear of the Lord was upon them, and they plundered all the cities, for there was much plunder in them. They struck down the tents of those who had livestock and carried away sheep in abundance and camels, and then they returned to Jerusalem. So, this battle against the Ethiopians really sends Asa's kingdom into a position of great strength economically and politically. The rest of chapter 15 is the religious reforms that we've already spoken about. But then in chapter 16, you get into the same issue that we're going to cover in 2 Kings, which is his battles with Baasha, the king of the northern kingdom. Okay, so let's turn to 1 Kings 15. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 16. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Raamah, that he might permit no one to go out or come in to King Asa. of Judah. So I'm going to show you on the map where this is. If you can see here, there's the Dead Sea. Everything up here is the northern kingdom of Israel. The things down here are the southern kingdom. During the reign of Abijam, right after Abijam defeated the northern army, he also took control of several major cities, including Beth-horon, Mizpah, and Bethel. What was at Bethel? What did the northern kingdom have at Bethel? Not the ark. One of the idols. Remember Jeroboam built two calves, covered them with gold. He put one way up north in Dan. He put the other one down here in Bethel. And Abijam conquers the city of Bethel, and so the southern kingdom expands its borders into the hill country of Ephraim just a little bit. Well, let me zoom in here so we can see a little bit better. Here's Bethel. So the border under Abijam came up here and encompassed Jericho and Bethel and some of the hills here at Ephraim. Right there is Ramah. So how does Baaka come down here to Ramah? The wars between Baasha and Asa have not been going in Asa's favor, apparently. Because Baasha is able to recapture Bethel, Mizpah, Beth-horon, Geba, and come down to Ramah. And he's fortifying Ramah, which really does tell us that he's probably conquered all of these other cities north of it as well. Now, Ramah is within just a couple hours' march of Jerusalem. So you're really getting close to the capital city here. And you can imagine if some of our enemies were marching in and were camping in Baltimore, that might make our politicians in Washington, D.C. just a little bit nervous, wouldn't it? If there was a major army fortifying Baltimore. Well, Baasha begins fortifying Bethel, begins fortifying Ramah because he wants to control the flow of trade and information between the two kingdoms. Ramah was a major trade route city, and so he's building it up. Now, based on how Asa has responded thus far, he's purged the kingdom, returned it back to the right worship of Jehovah. He called upon the Lord faithfully to defeat an army of 1 million Ethiopians. How's he going to respond here? And you say, Pastor, that sounds like a trick question. We should say he's going to respond faithfully, but I think I'm going to say he responds unfaithfully. How many of you say he's going to respond faithfully? Nobody's got faith in Asa. Boy, you're a bunch of doubters. How many of you think he's going to respond unfaithfully? How many of you are just unwilling to guess because you're not sure at this point? Okay, let's read what he does. Verse 18, Asa took all the silver and the gold that were left in the treasures of the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and he gave them into the hands of his servants, and King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, the king of Syria, who lived in Damascus. Let's zoom out for a moment so you can see where Damascus is. Oop, too far. So this is Israel with all of these jumbled names here. I can decrease the font so you can see a little better. This is Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah down here, Ephraim and the northern kingdoms here, and up here is Syria. Right there is Damascus, okay? So up here is Syria. This country has been a thorn in Israel's side for many years. David defeated them, reduced them to subjugation. But apparently, in the couple of generations that have been going on, they have gained a great deal of power back. And instead of calling out to the Lord in faith like he did with the Ethiopians, he decides to make a pact with Syria. So he strips the temple of all its treasures. And who put them there? Who put all those treasures in the temple? He did. So he must have felt like he had some claim to them then. So that he, well, I'm the one that donated all those things, right? I might as well go ahead and take some control of them. So he takes them back out, sends them by the hands of his servants up to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. And in verse 19, he says, "Let there be a covenant between me and you, as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I am sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go, break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me. Now, how secure would you think your treaties are if a person, if they just decide which treaty to abide by is the king that gave you the most money? Right? I guess things haven't changed all that much today, have they? Let there be a covenant. So, verse 20, Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa, sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel, and conquered Ejon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and all Kinnereth in all the land of Naphtali. So, the country of Syria comes down and captures all of this city, all of this region, even down around the Sea of Galilee, and reduces that to subjugation to the Syrians. So, we now have the northern kingdom has just been cut in half between what the Judeans took from them and what the Syrians have just taken from them. God promised Jeroboam, if you obey me, I'll establish you for a time because I want to teach Israel a lesson. You see, if you disobey me, I'm going to boot you guys out of this land. And Jeroboam disobeyed. He created those two calves. And so God is fulfilling his promise already, and we're only two kings removed from Jeroboam. And God is already working through the nations around Israel to dismantle the northern kingdom. See, by the time the Assyrians come in 722 BC and take Samaria, Israel has already shrunken down to a fairly small state. Anyway, they go back and forth for quite a while, but God is already beginning to reduce Israel. Verse 21, when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah and he lived in Tisra. Well, obviously, he doesn't have any military power anymore to carry out this plan of fortifying Ramah, so he leaves it off and just leaves everything there. Then King Asa made a proclamation to all Judah. None was exempt, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and its timber with which Baasha had been building, and with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. So those cities are not far away from Ramah, but he calls all the men of Israel to come to Ramah and cart off all the building supplies. So here's Mizpah, here's Geba. So this was Ramah. They take all of the building supplies from here and they move them to these two towns that are slightly north on the border with Israel. And they begin fortifying those. Wouldn't it be nice to have a huge supply of building materials just laying there for you? Baasha, the king of Israel, just left them. And so Asa begins to build these two fortified cities. Verse 23, now the rest of the acts of Asa, all his might and all that he did, and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? But in his old age he was diseased in his feet. And Asa slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father. And Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his place. Now, both the book of Kings and the book of Chronicles refer for us to the fact that Asa was a faithful man. He did what was right. The writer of Kings has a very pointed purpose. He's pointing to what made God kick Israel out of the land in 586 BC. Why did God work all of the events of Israelite history so that the Babylonians could come and take them captive? Why are we in the captivity? And it's because of the wickedness of the kings. So he doesn't include here the wickedness of Asa, the fact that he called upon Ben-Hadad to rescue him instead of calling on Jehovah, because that was not part of God's reasoning for kicking Israel out of the land. See that point? The book of Chronicles records it for us in detail that Asa, on two occasions, abandoned the Lord in his thinking. One of them was in relying upon Ben-Hadad rather than in relying on the Lord. The other was this disease in his feet. And it specifically says that in his old age, when he was diseased in his feet, he relied upon the physicians rather than relying upon the Lord. How many of you consult a physician on a regular basis? You can go ahead and raise your hands. Okay. We all do, right? So does that mean physicians are bad? We should never check with a doctor. I'm in Martin Luther's stuff right now, right? So I keep bringing up Martin Luther. But he says, somebody asked him, is it God's will that we consult with physicians? I have a friend that was very sick, and he goes and sees the doctor. And Martin Luther said, When he was hungry, did he eat? Okay. God has provided normal, natural means whereby we sustain our lives, right? So we're hungry, we eat. We're thirsty, we drink. That's not relying on God, is it? No, that's relying on something he gave us, natural means. It's okay. Same thing with physicians. So what's the point of saying that Asa relied on the physicians rather than on the Lord his God? Should he have just prayed for a miracle? Kathy's saying no. What's the difference?
He didn't go to God at all.
What's that?
He didn't go to God at all.
He didn't go to God at all. So why do we spend a lot of time praying for people that are going to doctors? Because we recognize the doctor's not the answer. He might be the tool that God uses, but he's not the answer. And there is a very big difference in our motivation. If I go to the doctor because I think he's going to be the one that's going to be able to take care of this and solve it for me, then I'm going with the wrong heart and wrong motivation. If I go to the doctor because I think he might be the tool that God uses to rescue me, then that's a whole different story, isn't it? Right? Asa missed that point toward the end of his life. We also get in the book of Chronicles a little statement that God sent a prophet to rebuke Asa for relying on Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, rather than relying on God. And guess what Asa did to that prophet? Beat him and threw him in prison. And then he began torturing some of the people of Judah. And so towards the end of his life, it seems like Asa began to veer off. But God took him. And so we get that the general tenor of his kingdom was he did what was right, but he had instances where he failed. It lines up with us as well, folks, doesn't it? When we look at our lives, we are going to have instances where we fail, where we don't do it right, where we didn't trust God the way we were supposed to, where we walked away from what his word tells us to do. We're going to have that. But that doesn't mean that somebody, including the Lord, wouldn't look at us and say, she did what was right. We want to strive not for perfection because it's not possible. Not in this flesh are we ever going to see a perfectly lived out obedience, are we? But that's not an excuse to disobey, but it tells us what we're striving for. When I mess up, what do? Confess it, forsake it, get back on track, and don't look back. Asa got distracted by these things, and he started wandering away toward the end, but God is good. And isn't it a good thing that our eternal relationship with him isn't based on our obedience? It's based on Christ's. And that was true in the Old Testament as much as it's true now. So here's a lesson for us. Asa gives us this great lesson. Be careful. A past success. How many of you guys get what do they call these things when they send you a statement from your retirement fund or an investment, a prospectus? And one of the first things your prospectus always says is past successes do not guarantee future results. Same thing's true spiritually speaking. Past successes don't guarantee future results. We have to be on guard every moment of every day. No matter how well I did yesterday, today is a new opportunity for me to blow it. Unless I'm relying on the Lord, on his strength, and determined to follow his word. And Asa gives us that great lesson. Any questions about all this? You keep